Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for 1 hour each weekday afternoon to take your phone calls. If you have questions about the Bible you'd like to raise or you have questions about the Christian faith, feel free to bring them up. If you are finding yourself disagreeing with something the host has said, feel free to bring that up. We can talk about that as well. We have all of our lines open right now. Sometimes the show goes on and we have all the lines full right now. We have them all open. And so you could get right through if you want to take advantage of this opportunity. The number to call is 844-484-5737. Once again, that number is 844-484-5737. Raphael wrote in and said, Steve, is Romans 14 and following about Paul's past experience before his conversion, or is he talking about something else? Well, the passage that Raphael's asking about is pretty familiar, I imagine, to most Christians. In Romans 7, Paul talks about frustration, the desire to do better, the fact that he says, I do the things I hate and I don't do the things I want to do. And he speaks out his frustration in that. And there are different views that people have held. They divide along two different lines. One is that he's writing about his circumstances as a Christian, and the other is that he's writing about circumstances before he was a Christian. So for those who think he was writing about his circumstances before he was a Christian, they would say, well, Paul, of course, was a Pharisee. He was a Jew. He was a religious man. But he didn't have Christ, and he didn't have the power of God to live a holy life. As a Pharisee, he knew what the law said he should do, and he even wanted to, but he was not able to do it because the power of sin in his flesh was too great, and therefore he was frustrated in his attempts to do what's right. So that he says, with my mind, he says in verse 22, I delight in the law of God according to the inward man. But he says, I see another law in my members warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members. Now, as I said, some people think Paul is talking about his life previous to conversion and that as a Pharisee he had this frustration, but that this frustration has ended by becoming a Christian. Now, there are others, the other view is that he is describing a Christian, and he is describing himself even as a Christian. Now, some say, you know, since there are different degrees of victory that different Christians have, he may be describing the frustration of somebody who isn't walking in victory for whatever reason. Some would say he has not yet experienced entire sanctification, if their theology is, accounts for that. Some would say he has not yet been baptized in the Holy Spirit. Others would say other things. But they would say that he's describing the life of a Christian, but a Christian without victory in his life. Now, again, we don't know if Paul ever had a season in his Christian life like that. We don't know if Paul had a second experience of sanctification or baptism in the Spirit or anything like that after conversion, which would make it possible for him to speak of this as, his Christian life before that point. And he certainly doesn't seem to be describing a very happy Christian life. And therefore, you know, there's all these different opinions about what he is talking about. I believe he's talking about every Christian's life. To say that becoming a Christian ends this frustration would simply be not realistic. And even in Galatians, Paul is writing to Christians, and he says in Galatians 5:17, for the flesh lusts against the spirit and the spirit against the flesh. And these two are contrary to one another so that you can't do what you want to do. Sounds very much like what he's saying in Romans 7, only in a shorter space in Galatians 5:17. Paul is describing Christians and the struggle that exists in the Christian life between the flesh and the spirit. Now, what is the way of overcoming that? Well, I believe he says in chapter 8, that as we walk in the Spirit, then we don't fulfill the lust of the flesh. That's what he said, actually, in Galatians 5:16. But in Romans 8, He also spoke about walking in the Spirit. In Romans 8, 4, he says that the righteous requirements of the law might be fulfilled in us who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. Now, notice in chapter 7, he's describing a sympathy with the righteous requirements of the law, but the inability to live up to that. But in Romans 8, 4, he says, but the righteous requirements of the law are fulfilled in us, that is, we do keep those righteous requirements successfully, when we walk not according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. So I take this to also be like Galatians 5:16. I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you will not fulfill the lust of the flesh. So what is Paul talking about? I believe what Paul is saying in Romans 7 is that the Christian, like anybody else, has to deal with sin in their flesh. But the Christian does have a resource the unbeliever doesn't have, and that is the Holy Spirit, so that we can walk in the Spirit. It is not a given that we will. It is, in fact, commanded that we should walk in the Spirit. And if we have to be commanded to do it, it must mean that we're not necessarily always doing so. We have to be told to do so. Now, if we walk in the Spirit, at those times that we are doing so, we don't fulfill the lust of the flesh, and we do fulfill the righteous requirements of the law. But when we don't walk in the Spirit, even though we're Christians, well, then we find that we cannot do what we want to do. The flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. If we're not walking in the Spirit, we find that we do not have the resources other than walking in the Spirit to overcome the flesh. And I think he says that very succinctly in Galatians 5, 16 and 17, and he says it more at length in Romans chapters 7 and 8. All right. We're going to talk first of all today to Daryl from Sacramento, California. Daryl, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. My question deals with works as far as salvation is concerned, whether or not when you're saved, are works mandatory or are they optional, or after you get saved, your sanctification, must there be works to present evidence?
Well, are you a father? Do you have children?
No.
Okay. Well, but you once had parents and you were a child in their home, right?
Yes.
Was it mandatory for you to obey your parents?
Yeah, or else.
Okay, so in other words, obedience to your parents was in fact mandatory. It was not optional, right?
Yeah.
But what if you did disobey your parents? Did they disown you and cease to be your parents?
No.
Okay, so this is how God treats us. We've been adopted as sons into his family. We've been born again into his family. We're his children. We have an obligation to obey him, don't we? I mean, it's not optional. It's mandatory. When you're a child, you're supposed to obey your parent. And we're supposed to obey God, as dear children do. Now, if we are disobedient, does that mean we stop being his children? Not necessarily. Now, a child could go so far as to disown their parents, sort of like the prodigal son who left his dad and turned his back on him and just seemed to disown him. However, he did come back. But while he was away from his dad, he was lost. While he was away from his dad, in fact, we're told he was dead. And when he came back, he was alive and not lost anymore. That is, when the child was alienated from his father, he had no benefits for being a son. Now, if you're a son in obedience to your father and fellowship with your father, then you have all the benefits of family, of sonship. If a child disowns his parents and goes off and lives in a far country, well, one could argue theoretically that he's still a son. But so what? It doesn't matter. He's gaining nothing from his sonship. He's not, none of the advantages of being a son are his. He's alienated from his father. And that would be something that would be possible, I believe, with our relationship with God also. If we decide that we don't want to be in God's family, and we decide we want to renounce God, this is what's called apostasy. And I think when people apostatize, that they aren't saved anymore. But it's not because of their works, it's because of the relationship. They've renounced their relationship with God. Now, if you're saved, it's not because of your works, It's because of your relationship with God. Before the son left his father's house, he had all the advantages of being a son. That would be similar to being saved. All the advantages of being a son of God are ours as we have a relationship with God. If we renounce that relationship and throw it away, well, then none of the advantages of being a child of God are going to be ours. But short of that, even if we stay, you know, if we stay on good terms with God, but we sometimes fall short of being completely obedient, well, that doesn't change our sonship status. If we stay in relationship with God, then we're still, you know, children, and we still have our salvation. But what does it mean to stay in a relationship with God? It means that we're still his children. It means we treat him as our father. We view him as the one that we must honor and respect and obey. As long as you have this relationship with God, you're saved. Now, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was wondering if this has any relation to Isaac and Esau. No, Esau and Jacob. I mean, Esau sold his birthright, but he still was the father, chosen son, so forth.
Well, I don't know that there's any kind of direct connection with the situation with Jacob and Esau and our own salvation, because the relationship of Jacob and Esau to their father did not determine their salvation. The birthright that Esau got rid of was a special privilege that only one child in the family could have, even though other children in the family could be on good terms with their parents. In other words, there's lots of people in Abraham's family, as you go down the generations, who were truly members of his family and on good terms with him and with God, but only one could be the one through whom the Messiah would come. And that's what Esau would have had at birth, except he gave that up. He gave up that special privilege. So Esau's family, the Edomites, did not become the ones who brought the Messiah into the world, but Jacob's family, the Jews, Israel, were the ones that brought the Messiah. So what Esau forfeited was the earthly privilege of having his family be the ones through whom the Messiah would come. But that doesn't mean that he gave up his relationship with his family or that he, you know, wasn't on good terms with his father. He definitely was on good terms with his father. And not very much with Jacob, though. But, yeah, I don't see a direct connection there. What I see is, of course, we are told that we should not be like Esau in Hebrews chapter 12, I think it is. We shouldn't be like Esau, who gave up his birthright for such a tawdry price. He took one meal when he was hungry and exchanged that for his birthright. Now, our birthright is something more than that, of course. Our birthright is our salvation. Our birthright is our relationship with God, and we shouldn't sacrifice that for you know, short-term gratification like Esau did. But I don't think Esau was lost or lost his relationship with his father by selling his birthright.
Thank you for answering my question.
Okay, Daryl, thank you for calling and asking your questions. Let's talk to Daylin from Daylin from Seattle, Washington. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks, Steve. It's good to talk to you. Appreciate your ministry. I've been going through almost all of your stuff online. So
great.
First off, one thing that I'm noticing with all of the different lectures debates with gentlemen like Matt Flick and Tommy Nelson and a number of different gentlemen, that I'm finding a problem with English as a language. If you could comment on that and the fact that I believe, somebody has once said, sloppy language leads to sloppy opens people up to sloppy beliefs or sloppy understanding. And that's my first question, if you could comment on that. And the second question, if I could, I understand that there's different schools of thought as far as eternal security and that, and I've heard all the debates, and so I'm aware. And I understand, and I follow more along the believer is eternally secure as they maintain their belief, and I don't see that as something that's really hard to do. I get your point.
Right.
What I have a difficulty with is I think that the opposition to that point in eternal security, it seems to me as though there's an unspoken or an underlying driving motivation to that for those of us that are not scholarly and, you know, do that, this on a hour-by-hour basis. It seems like there's an underlying motivation. I'm wondering if you could potentially comment on that.
Well, I'm going to ask you to stay on the line because I need clarification on both your questions. Your first question, you wanted me to comment on, you said you're having trouble with the English language. Now, that's a very vague statement. I'm not sure what you're referring to, so maybe you could clarify what the problem is there.
The exactness of it. There's English words that mean five things, and when you read them in any version of the Bible, you can see the discrepancies either all the way around. And the people that are deep theologians, such as, well, I know you wouldn't call yourself one, but people that debate this stuff still seem to be arguing over the definition of words, and that seems to me to be difficult. It's hard for me. I feel like it's almost a spiritual thing to where English is such a mundane language to where there's so many different ways you can interpret the same word, whereas it seems like Latin, Greek, Hebrew, those types of languages are more exact languages where you could actually, if you knew those languages, you could actually communicate better with more exactness. Does that make sense?
Well, I think so. But that's why, of course, when you're debating theology from the scriptures, you actually need to appeal to the original languages. Because many times an English translation reflects too much the translator's leanings rather than what's actually in the original language. When you said one English word can mean five different things, I think you're probably using hyperbole because there's not very many words that can mean five different things. There are some, perhaps, but usually an English word means one or maybe two or possibly three or four things at the most, but usually in a given context, it can only mean one thing or possibly, in some cases, two. That is to say, there could be some ambiguity in some cases where a word has two possible meanings and, you're not quite sure which works better in the context of the sentence. In that case, of course, you've got to go with what the train of thought of the author is to see which point he's more likely making in the course of his argument. There's a lot of things to consider in exegesis, and that includes the context and the flow of thought of the author and also the meaning of the words in the Greek and the Hebrew language. Now, the English, it's not very wise ever to debate a nuanced theological topic using only the English Bible, because almost anyone can find a translation in English that was translated by somebody who holds a view like their own and has chosen words in English that sound like they may support their view. But when you do check it against the original languages, you can see whether one translation is fudging a little bit more than another. So I'm not really sure what to comment about this, but I would say that any debate that depends wholly on English translations of ambiguous verses is not going to get you very far. You're going to have to, resort to the original languages, at least on verses that are at the center of controversy. Of course, I would say in all likelihood 97% of the verses, I just made that statistic up off the top of my head, but I think it would be pretty close. I'd say about 97% of the verses in the Bible, they're not ambiguous at all, but they're not controversial at all either. I mean, pretty much everyone would agree what they mean. There might be 3% or less of the verses of the Bible that are controversial because they're not quite, they're a little more ambiguous, and a person's going to read them into the paradigm that they already are accepting. So if someone's accepting a Calvinist paradigm, they're going to read them through that lens. If they're accepting an Arminian paradigm, they're going to read through that lens. Or if they have a dispensational paradigm, they'll read it through that lens. Or if they have a Reformed paradigm, they'll read it through that lens, so forth. So there are times when the English translation's ambiguity are a problem, but it's really in very rare cases. But still, there's enough of them that you have to actually look at the original languages to solve the problem. Unless, of course, you can already do that by appeal to other passages that are clearer and that aren't ambiguous.
I think that points out my kind of understanding or what I'm trying to get at.
And then you're asking about the underlying motives of people who, what, who teach eternal security? Is that what you're asking about, the second question?
Not necessarily the teachers of it so much as those that seem to follow it. I have a suspicion, or I feel as though the people that teach or follow, I would go with that group, of people that follow unconditional security seem to either have one of two or three underlying motivations for kind of hitching their wagon to that belief system. And I'm wondering if I'm accurate in my understanding or my thinking of it. It seems as though people that believe in eternal security, unconditional, might potentially have somebody that they have in mind that they know once believed and now does not, and mm-hmm. either has passed on or lives in sin, and they just in their hearts they can't bear the thought of them dying in their sin and living apart from them in eternity.
I think that's very often part of it. I think mothers whose children accepted Christ, so to speak, as children, but who grew up to be non-Christians, those mothers and fathers especially are hoping, and I think in cases, many cases, hoping against hope, that the childhood profession of faith is somehow going to carry them through on the day of judgment, even though they live their whole adult life in rebellion against God. And therefore, a doctrine like unconditional eternal security that says, well, once you're saved, you're always saved no matter what, that kind of a doctrine is definitely going to appeal to someone who doesn't know better than to believe it, and who has those motivations. There's other motives. There's probably three different motivations I could imagine for someone believing in eternal security, unconditional eternal security. One of them is the one you mentioned. You know, someone you love is backslidden, and you're hoping that, you know, their profession of faith at an earlier point of life is going to be what counts for their status on the day of judgment. Another, of course, is that the people themselves want to be saved, and they want to believe they're saved even though they don't want to live an obedient life. There are certainly people in that category. They want to sin. They love their sin. They don't love God. They love their sin, but they think they can be saved because they said a prayer or were baptized or did something else of a religious nature at an earlier point in their life, but they've never really lived for God, or they've stopped doing so, and they hope that their present sinful life will be kind of ignored by God because of something they did earlier. That's another motivation some people might have. So one person might be motivated to believe in unconditional eternal security because they want to live in sin. Another may be inclined to believe in it because somebody they know is living in sin and they hope they won't be lost. Of course, there's a third possibility, and that is that they believe it's really true based on Scripture. I was raised in a church that taught unconditional eternal security, and I believed in once saved, always saved. But I didn't want to live in sin. I wanted to follow Jesus. I did eventually change my doctrines, but not out of any preference. I just changed them because I studied the Scripture more. But I think a lot of people haven't studied the Scripture as much as they need to, and they're in a denomination or have heard teaching from someone who says, well, once saved, always saved. They just assume that must be what the Bible teaches. They have a few Bible verses they've never thought very carefully about that sound like they might teach it, and so they hang their hat on it. And this is their sincere belief based on the Bible, but it's based on a very inferior consideration, in my opinion, of the meaning and context of the verses that they are trusting in. Lots of people have sincerely held wrong beliefs, which they base on the Bible. But if somebody's views are based on the Bible and they're wrong, it must mean that their use of the Bible is somehow compromised. They're not very good at doing the exegetical study they need to do to understand it. And I think there's people like that. I think a lot of people like that believe in eternal security, but they don't want to live in sin. And they're not trying to make excuses for someone they know who's living in sin. They just believe that's what the Bible teaches. And so that's where they stand on it, even if they want to live a holy life. I remember, you know, people used to say, well, you know, people who believe in the pre-trib rapture, they just want to be able to escape suffering and persecution. Well, some of them probably do, but that's a similar kind of statement. You can't really know what's in the heart of somebody until you get to know more about what makes them tick. But I once believed in the pre-trib rapture, but I only believed it because I thought that's what the Bible taught. I didn't think that we would escape all tribulation or persecution or even martyrdom. In fact, when I was young, I knew that Christians were being martyred around the world, and I knew that I might be martyred, and I was open to that. But I still believed that the church would be raptured before the tribulation, not because it mattered to me. I mean, I couldn't imagine how any future tribulation could be worse than what many Christians are going through right now or what Christians have gone through in many parts of the world throughout history. I can't imagine a worse tribulation than what we read in Fox's Book of Martyrs. But even though I knew that Christians might have to be martyrs, and I might have to be, I still thought that the Bible taught a pre-trib rapture, so I taught it anyway. So, I mean, you can see that some of these doctrines, like an unconditional, once saved, always saved doctrine, or a pre-tribulation rapture doctrine, those doctrines might appeal to people who have bad motives. But that doesn't mean that only people with bad motives have them. You know, a lot of people teach them because they really, that's how they've been told the scriptures to be understood.
Can I ask one, or make one observation and see if it okay. has mm-hmm. a footing?
Sure.
Really quickly, is that I noticed one thing about once saved, always saved doctrine, regardless, is it seems to absolve the believer that's in realm, say the mother with a child that's wayward, seems to absolve them of the necessity or the compulsion to continually woo and draw and abandon all in order to reach out to the drowning person in the water, as it were. And it seems to, like, because they don't want to offend the person and they want to push them away, don't want to risk losing the relationship in the here and now, they don't bear into that. And
You're probably right. I'm sure there are. I'm sure that is applicable in many cases. Once again, I wouldn't apply it to all cases, but because there would be some people who would be eager to see their children live a godly life, even if they believe their children might be saved without living one, and they might still be motivated to try to draw their children in. But I'm sure you're right that many people, what they want mostly is to not alienate their children from themselves. You know, so lots of people are emotionally needy, requiring their children's approval, especially single parents are very much in danger of this. You know, the only family they have is their kids, and so the last thing they want is to alienate them. And so
C.S. Lewis points out in his book, Mere Christianity, he talks about the love that's not love, but it's basically a selfish love. And two of the examples that we've referred to, not the third, the genuine believer of eternal security, but the two seem to be a almost a false love that C.S. Lewis describes, to where they love them to their own peril. They do not do what's necessary in order to love them to the uttermost, to where ultimately I want this person to remain in glory with me and God, or with God and to their righteousness. And if I am more concerned about my relationship with them in the here and now, then I have an issue. That's a selfish motivation of sorts.
Well, I agree with you. Hey, thank you for your call.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. God bless you. All right. Our next caller is Michelle from Lopez Island, Washington. Michelle, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thank you so much for your ministry. I just was reading about Melchizedek the other day, and he's such a mystery. And I just wondered what else you can tell me about him.
Well, were you reading in Hebrews or were you reading in Genesis?
Yes, it was Hebrews. I couldn't remember where. It was Hebrews.
Yeah. Well, Melchizedek's a mysterious character in the Old Testament, but mostly because so little is said about him. And the few things that are said about him are mysterious. They raise questions. For example, he's only mentioned in the historical narrative of Genesis 14 in a space of, what, four or five verses, and that's all.
Yeah.
And then he's mentioned in one other Old Testament verse in the Psalms, in Psalm 110 in verse 4, he's mentioned, or more properly, his order of priesthood is mentioned, the order of Melchizedek. The Messiah is going to be a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, it says in Psalm 110, verse 4. But most of the information about the man himself is found in Genesis 14, and there's not much there. It's a very brief account, but even being brief, it says a large number of things that are questionable. First of all, we're told that Melchizedek was the king of Salem. Now, the question then is, what is meant by Salem? Many people believe Salem, which is a form of shalom, peace, is a reference to Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem, of course, we think of as the Jewish capital city after the time of David. But in the time of Abraham, when Melchizedek arrived, Jerusalem was not a Jewish city. There weren't even any Jews. Abraham, you know, Abraham was the founder of the Jewish race, and he didn't have a race that he'd founded yet. So Jerusalem in those days was simply a Canaanite city, and the Canaanites were pagans. And so if this is saying the man was the king of Jerusalem, it would appear that he would have been the king of a Canaanite city, a pagan city. But then it tells us in Genesis 14 that he was a priest of the Most High God. Now, the Most High God, El Elyon in Hebrew, is not a term used for God previously to that, but Abraham picks it up. Melchizedek swears by the Most High God, and then Abraham makes a reference to the Most High God. And so we have God referred to as the Most High God, and Melchizedek is his priest, and yet he's the king of Salem. But if Salem is Jerusalem, then that's a pagan city, and it's really difficult. And then he brought out bread and wine to Abraham and his exhausted troops, and Abram gave him a tithe or a tenth of all the spoils of the battle. And that's all we really learn about him. Oh, and he blessed Abraham. So that's, you know, those are interesting things to say about a person, but without further background, we just, you know, you could read through Genesis 14 and be left with the scratch in your head and say, what was that all about? But when you come to Hebrews 7, the author devotes an entire chapter to explaining Melchizedek. And he doesn't use anything more than what he finds in Genesis and in the Psalm that says you're a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. First, though, he says, let's start from scratch. What does the name Melchizedek mean? Well, the name means king of righteousness. That's the translation of the word Melchizedek. It means king of righteousness. So the writer of Hebrews starts out by telling us that. Okay, he's the king of righteousness. What else do we know? Well, he's the king of Salem. The writer of Hebrews says that means shalom, the king of peace. So the writer of Hebrews doesn't believe he was the king of a city called Salem or Jerusalem. He believed he was the king of peace and the king of righteousness. So just from those two things, from Genesis 14, he's got some real interesting observations. This man was the king of righteousness and the king of peace. Already that begins to make us think of Jesus, although as the writer goes on, he gives us more reasons to think about Jesus. He says that Melchizedek was, in verse 3, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, he remains a priest continually. Now notice what it says about Melchizedek. Like Jesus, Melchizedek remains a priest continually. That's in the present tense. Melchizedek to this day remains a priest. So how could he have been an ordinary man meeting Abraham 4,000 years ago if he continues to this day to remain a priest? It says he has no beginning of days or end of life, and no genealogy, no father and mother. Now, scholars usually think that this is not to be taken literally, but that the writer is only saying that Melchizedek's father and mother and lineage and the day of his birth and death are not recorded for us. Well, it is true. Those things are not recorded if they existed. But the lack of them being recorded is no evidence they didn't exist. If you read, you know, most of the priests in the Old Testament, we don't read who their father or mother were. We don't read their day of birth or their day of death. There's a few priests we read that about, but most of the priests in the Old Testament, we don't read those things. So to be lacking that information about Melchizedek would not be notable. Except the writer of Hebrews says it is notable. He had no father and mother. He had no beginning of days or end of days. He remains to this day a priest continually. He's still alive. Now, this point is also made about him a little further down, because he says that a little further on down, it says in verse 8, here, and the writer means here in the Jewish temple system, which was still operating when he wrote this, here mortal men received tithes. That is, the priests, the Aaronic priests were in the temple, and they received tithes for their upkeep. But he says, but there, and by this he means when Abraham met Melchizedek back in Genesis 14, there he received them of whom it is witnessed that he lives. Now, who did receive tithes in that story? Melchizedek did. Abraham gave tithes, or a tenth of everything, to Melchizedek. Now, the writer of Hebrews says, now there's a difference here between Melchizedek, who received tithes from Abraham, on the one hand, and the priests who are currently ministering in the temple. What is the difference? He says, well, the priests who minister in the temple, they die. In other words, they're mortal. But Melchizedek, who received tithes, it is testified about him, even to this day it's testified, that he lives, present tense. Now, this is interesting, because the point he's making is Melchizedek differs from the Aaronic priests in one respect, at least, that the Aaronic priests are mortal, they die. And if he's contrasted from them in that particular, then he doesn't die, he was not mortal. He didn't have a beginning of days or end of life. This would suggest very strongly that he was what we call a theophany. In the Old Testament, Jesus or God sometimes appeared in a visible form, sometimes in a human form. As, for example, in Genesis 18:1, when it says Abraham saw Yahweh, and he looked up and saw three men coming to him, and two of them were angels, and one was Yahweh, and he actually entertained them in his tent and fed them a meal, and then had a conversation with Yahweh, God, after that. There was a man who wrestled all night with Jacob, and Jacob recognized that man as God in a human form. There are other cases, as you read through the Old Testament, of what we call theophanies, where God actually appears in a human form. And there's a very good reason to suspect that the writer of Hebrews is telling us Melchizedek was an example of that very phenomenon, that God, or Christ, appeared in a human form. And that's why we're told that he had no birth and no death, no parents, no genealogy, and that he remains to this day a priest continually. Now, there's a difference also in the Aaronic priesthood mentioned in Hebrews 7:23. It says there, meaning in the Jewish temple, there were many priests because they were prevented by death from continuing. What he means by that is the priesthood, or the temple service, lasted for centuries. But none of the priests last that long, so they're prevented by death from continuing as long as the system goes on. So they die and they leave another successor, and the successor eventually dies and leaves a successor. And by this means, there are many priests in the Old Testament system because they have to succeed each other because of death. By contrast, it says in verse 24, but he, because he continues forever, has an unchangeable priesthood. Now, unchangeable means does not transfer from one person to the next. Unlike Aaron's priesthood that transferred from him to his son, and then to his grandson, then to his great-grandson each generation, the Melchizedek priesthood does not change. It does not transfer. It doesn't go from person to person. It's always with the same person. Now, that's an interesting thing to suggest, because if the Melchizedek priesthood does not transfer from one man to another, how is it that Melchizedek had it in the days of Abraham, and Jesus has it now? If it doesn't transfer from one man to another, how is it that Melchizedek had it and Jesus has it? Mm. Did it transfer from Melchizedek to Jesus? No, it couldn't, because it doesn't transfer from one man to the next. We would have to say that Jesus is Melchizedek.
That's kind of what I thought.
Yeah. Well, most commentators wouldn't agree with this, though there's a lot of Christian teachers who would agree with me on this. But a lot of commentators, they always want to make it out that Melchizedek was an ordinary man, a priest of some early form of religion, and the king of a city called Jerusalem at the time, and that, you know, he's mentioned here because he's such an interesting type of Christ. But that doesn't work with the author of Hebrews. The author of Hebrews is not going to praise a man in the Old Testament who is a type of Christ. After all, Moses was a type of Christ. So was Joshua. But the writer of Hebrews has already spoken of Moses and Joshua, and all he has said about them is they weren't that great compared to Jesus. In other words, the writer of Hebrews, from the very beginning of his book, is praising Jesus above all important Old Testament characters, including angels and Moses and Aaron and Joshua. It doesn't matter who you name. The writer of Hebrews is going to say that guy was great, but Jesus was so much greater that it eclipses them. But look what he says about Melchizedek in Hebrews 7:4. After he tells us about Melchizedek in the Old Testament, he says, now consider how great this man was to whom even the patriarch Abraham gave a tenth of his spoils. Now, what a strange thing for the writer of Hebrews to do. After talking about these other men who were types of Christ, Moses, Aaron, Joshua, and saying they weren't that great. But now if he's talking about another ordinary man who's just a type of Christ, how come he changes up his language and says, oh, we got to think about how great this man was, this Melchizedek. Oh, what a great guy. Well, I thought the writer of Hebrews was trying to point out that Jesus was great, greater than everybody, and that everyone else was kind of not so great compared to him. But how strange that the writer would spend a whole chapter extolling the virtues of this man, Melchizedek. Unless, of course, in doing so, it's Jesus he's talking about.
Hmm. Yeah, well, that's kind of what I thought, but that gives me a lot more information. Well,
there's
you.
One, yeah, there's one verse that some people say would disprove this particular theory. And it's a verse I already read in verse 3, where it says that Melchizedek was without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, remains a priest continually. They say, look, he's like the Son of God. He isn't the Son of God. He's not Jesus. He's just someone like him in this respect. No, that's not the way I see it. When he refers to the Son of God, he's referring to Jesus in his incarnation, Jesus in his life here. He was born of God, and God was his father, and he lived among us as the Son of God. And Melchizedek was like that. Well, like what? Well, if Melchizedek was Jesus, was the, let's just say, the second person of the Trinity, manifested in a human form, and so was Jesus at his birth, the Son of God is also a manifestation of the same eternal Word in human form, then Melchizedek was like him in that respect. That is, both Melchizedek and Jesus were manifestations of the same eternal Word, but at different times and different manifestations, but the same being manifested.
Hmm. Well, that gives me a lot to think about. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Okay, Michelle, thanks for your call.
And
it's good talking
to you.
You're
very inspiring. You make people want to read the Bible more.
Well, I hope so. Great. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Read on.
All right, thank you so much.
Okay, God bless you, Michelle. All right, let's talk to Tom from Albany, Oregon next. Tom, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have a question about the tribe of Gad.
Uh-huh.
One of the tribes that asked to be given land on the east side of the Jordan.
Yeah.
On another radio station, the commentator was saying that he was the descendants of Gad were in the country of the Gergesenes, or, you know, the maniac of Gadara who was demon-possessed.
Okay,
and
yeah.
And so they went bad because they were out of the will of God by staying on the east side of the Jordan. Do you see it that way?
Well, I mean, the fact that the demon-possessed man was a Gergesene and came from a region where the tribe of Gad had once been doesn't tell us anything about the tribe as a whole. I mean, every family has their black sheep, you know, and to have a man who was demon-possessed who, even if he was of the tribe of Gad, we're not told that he was, but even if he was of the tribe of Gad, it would not necessarily mean that the whole tribe went bad just because we have a bad example in this man of one who is demon-possessed. I think that's extrapolating considerably too far. Now, I think many preachers would probably say that the tribe of Reuben and the tribe of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh that stayed on the east side of the Jordan were making a bad decision, that it was a carnal decision. They wanted to be there because there were good pasture lands and for their sheep, even though they had no reason to believe that there weren't equally good or better pasture lands on the other side of the Jordan where God wanted them to go. Moses made a concession to them that they could live on the east side of the Jordan if they would first go and conquer the land on the west side with their other tribes, and then they could return and live on the east side. And they did, but the problem was that it was no doubt a carnal and foolish decision on their part. But we wouldn't deduce that from anything that happened in the ministry of Jesus. The tribe of Gad didn't even exist anymore as a tribe in the time of Jesus. The people in the Gadarenes or the Gergesenes on that side of the Jordan and that side of the Sea of Galilee where Jesus was, those would not be the original tribes of Israel that were over there, because the Assyrians had conquered all of those tribes in 722 BC and carried them away for the most part and intermixed them with Gentiles so that they intermarried and became essentially the Samaritan people. There's no reason to believe that the people of the Gergesenes were, you know, descended from Gad or any other particular tribe of Israel. They were probably had as much Gentile blood in them as any Israelite did. And so I think he's making something out of that that doesn't really work. I would agree with the preacher in his assumption that the people of Gad made a bad decision. And one of the things that made it bad was, of course, the land that God gave to Israel on the west side of Jordan had natural protections. There was this, the Mediterranean on the west side. There was the River Jordan on the east side. And there were deserts to the north and south, which made it difficult for people to invade. Crossing a river was one of the harder things to do in invading a country. In fact, most of the countries that did invade Israel had to go around the river and come on down from the north. But what's interesting is that the people of Gad and Manasseh and, Reuben that settled over there, they settled in land that didn't have any natural protections. They were on the same side of the Jordan as all their enemies were. And therefore, they were easily overrun, and they were overrun. And they ceased to exist long before Jesus was born. So the Gergesenes in Jesus' day were not necessarily Gadites.
Okay, well, that was a very good answer, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, Tom, thanks for your call. God bless you. Everett from San Pablo, California. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. I really appreciate your, the thoroughness of your answer relative to Melchizedek. That brought some eye-opening, illumination. Also, in regard to that, I was thinking about the text over in the book of Hebrews. It says, and here men that die receive tithes, but there he receiveth them of whom it is witnessed that he liveth.
Yeah.
Could you explain that text? Because that made me think the fact that it says, there he receiveth them of whom it is witnessed that he liveth. And
yeah.
So I know that there's no New Testament tithing for the church, the body of Christ, but right there, that particular text says that. Could you explain that?
Yeah.
It seems to indicate that he receiveth them now.
Well, okay, there, it says there he receives them. Now, the word receives them is in italics.
Right,
which means it's not in the Greek, but if you take out the italics, it says here mortal men receive tithes, but there he of whom it is witnessed that he lives, and all it's really saying is there, meaning in the story of Abraham and Melchizedek, the man who received tithes from Abraham historically was in fact the one of whom it is now witnessed that he lives. Now, I think it's interesting. It doesn't say whether, you know, tithing would still go on to him in modern times. It's just referring back to the historical fact that Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek. And the point it's making about Melchizedek is not so much that, you know, somehow forever we pay tithes to him, but rather that he's not a mortal man, not like the priests in the temple who are mortals and who die. Melchizedek is not a mortal, and he did not die. And what I always found confusing is why it says it is witnessed of him, that is of Melchizedek, it is witnessed of him that he lives. Where do we find that witness? I mean, it'd be one thing for the writer of Hebrews to say, but Melchizedek lives. Unlike them, he lives. Well, that'd be fine. He's just making that assertion would be helpful to know. But he says it is witnessed about him that he lives. And that suggests that someone out there is witnessing or testifying that Melchizedek lives. But who? We don't find any reference in the Old Testament that says Melchizedek is living still. And, of course, apart from Hebrews 7, we don't have any affirmation of anything about Melchizedek in the New. But the writer of Hebrews is referring to some witness about Melchizedek that he lives, which is independent of him writing this book. He's alluding to something that his readers apparently know very well, that it is witnessed of him that he lives. But who's witnessing it? I believe this, too, assumes that Melchizedek is Christ. Because the great confession of the church, the great witness of the church, is that Jesus lives. He died, but he's risen indeed, and he's alive today. That Jesus is alive is the primary witness of the church. It is the focal witness that Jesus is risen. He's alive. It is witnessed of Jesus that he lives. And since the writer is equating Jesus with Melchizedek, he can say it is witnessed of Melchizedek. In the Christian confession that Jesus lives, they are bearing witness that Melchizedek lives. It is witnessed of him that he lives, it says. So it's a very strange statement. But it can't really be given any kind of obvious meaning other than that he's saying Melchizedek is Jesus. And by our professing that Jesus lives, we are professing that Melchizedek lives because he's the same guy.
Wow. Okay. Gotcha.
All right?
Wow. Okay, gotcha. Thank you so much, Steve. I'll listen on the air. Thank you, sir.
Okay, Everett. Thanks for your call. God bless you. You know, I want to let you know that the Narrow Path radio broadcast is a listener-supported ministry. And as I've told you before, we don't have any payroll or any overhead here. We have no offices, no secretaries, no employees. I am not paid. Nobody is paid. Our web guy is not paid. The podcast guy is not paid. Nobody is paid. Everybody in this ministry is a volunteer. It's the leanest operation you could hope for in a ministry. There's no fat. But it is expensive nonetheless because we buy radio time from lots of radio stations. And that radio time costs us between $30,000 and $40,000 a month. And we don't have anything for sale. We have no advertising, no sponsors. We have no underwriters. We don't have any newsletter or any way of generating funds like that. We just tell you at the end of each show, we are listener supported. If that matters to you, and if you'd like to help us stay in the air, you may want to send a gift. You may not. If you do, and if enough people do, we stay on the air. It's just that simple. If we don't get enough gifts, then we don't have the money to pay the radio stations, and then we don't stay on the air. That's the simple economics of running a radio ministry. If you'd like to write to us, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That address again is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. It is also possible to donate if you wish to at our website, but I want you to know of our website. I want you to think of our website not as a place primarily to donate, but a place where we donate to you. Everything at the website is free to you, and we have hundreds of resources there, and they're all free. We have about something like 900 MP3 files, lectures, verse by verse through the Bible, lectures on hundreds of topics. We have many years of archives of this radio program going back to, I think, 2006, if I'm not mistaken. All these things, thousands of MP3 files altogether, you can just have them. Just take them. We won't even know you took them because we don't ask you to sign up or give us your email address. You receive no spam from us. You just go and take what you want and enjoy and benefit from it. That's what we want you to think of our website as. If you want to donate at the website, it can be done. But the website is thenarrowpath.com. Just like the radio program itself, it's thenarrowpath.com. My name is Steve Gregg, and we do this Monday through Friday at the same time. And you can also get our app for the iPhone. Go to the App Store and look up thenarrowpath.com, and you can get the app, and then you can hear everything on your phone, the radio program live and archived, as well as many of the lectures that are at our website. Check that out at the App Store, thenarrowpath.com. Once again, if you want to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. And we are so glad that you're a listener and a caller when you need to be. And we hope you'll listen regularly if you haven't made a habit of that yet. Have a good weekend, and may God bless you. We'll talk again Monday, Lord willing.